The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I think you're mixing a lot of streams here. When Michael Hayden says we kill people based upon metadata, presumably those are done according to the rule of law and that those are persons who are at war with the United States. That's a different matter than what is happening right now with respect to the tete-a-tete vis-a-vis FBI and Apple. We're talking about a U.S. person, right, whose phone is in the possession of the FBI, and they need help understanding what's on that so that they might then pursue a criminal, possibly a terrorist investigation. We can argue as to whether there's a lot of data already available to cover that waterfront, but that's the nice thing about the commission. All sides that enter into that will go in believing that their position will be affirmed, and my bet is they're going to be shocked, stunned, and amazed when they get into the room to realize that it's complicated, that there are different views, and that if they're charged properly, they'll have to reconcile those views inside that room and come out with something that they would collectively recommend that covers the waterfront of all those distinguished interests. And so I would leave terms like specious and dragnet and backdoor and heavy-handed off the table and say, let's go in and see if we can't solve this problem from a principal perspective and drive engineering to our purpose.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is a Lawfare podcast, February 27th, 2016. That was the voice of Chris Inglis, former Deputy Director of the National Security Agency, discussing the security and technology challenges of the digital age. This week, the Bipartisan Policy Center hosted Chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee Michael McCaul and Senator Mark Warner to an event unveiling their new legislation that would create a commission tasked with developing viable recommendations on how to balance competing digital security priorities. Following the discussion with Congressman McCaul and Senator Warner, Jim Lewis, Susan Hennessy, and Michael German joined Inglis on a panel to discuss the merits of the proposal and what the likely outcome would be. David Pereira moderated the event. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 159, How to Solve the Encryption Challenge.
Welcome to the BPC. I'm Blaise Mischtal. I'm the director of the National Security Program. If I could encourage everyone to grab a lunch and take your seats, we're going to get started. There's plenty of seats over on the left-hand side of the room, so if you want to swing around, you can go through the back door, which is an encryption joke. Just to set the stage a little bit. The Bipartisan Policy Center exists to bring people together, but we do that not just because we like talking to people, but because we believe that only by coming together can we get our government working to address the major challenges facing our country. And the topic we'll be discussing today is fundamentally about that same question, beyond the technology and beyond the specifics of what's in the headlines today. It's about, can our government find a way to design responsible policies that reflect the values and priorities of the American people? Or will, or perhaps should, the role of government be eclipsed by fast-moving technological developments that wait for no one? Demonstrating that Congress is not out of this race, we are delighted to have House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Michael McCaul and Senator Mark Warner, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, back at BPC to present a very timely legislative idea, the formation of an independent digital security commission, which will assemble the brightest minds from all major stakeholder groups to conduct a deep dive into the challenges of digital security, including encryption. Chairman McCaul and Senator Warner demonstrate not only that bipartisan and bicameral cooperation exists, but also something even more important than that, that it is possible to overcome the Redskins-Cowboy rivalry. Just to give you a run of show for today, we will have a 30-minute discussion with these two distinguished members about the work they are doing, including some questions from the audience, followed by an expert panel that will bring up to give their views, including views from security and privacy experts, policymakers, and technologists. I'll also point out that our discussion today is being webcast live, and for those watching online, please tweet to us at @BPC_bipartisan and #BPCLive, and we'll submit those questions to the panel as well. And so to discuss the digital security challenge, I'd like to turn it over to David Pereira, cybersecurity reporter for Politico, who's going to facilitate our discussion today.
Thank you so much for coming. So, Chairman McCaul, Senator Warner, you're going to be introducing a bill in the two chambers to set up a commission to address the going dark problem, as the FBI calls it. When can we expect the bill?
Well, we think next week, early next week. It's timely. I think Congress has a responsibility to act on this. And Senator Warner has great high-tech experience, serves on the Intel Committee. I chair Homeland, so I'm close to federal law enforcement, but I'm also very close to the tech community. We're actually in very unique, I think, positions to bring the relevant stakeholders together to find a solution to this very grave problem. And that's the whole point of the bill and the commission, is to find a solution to a Paris-style attack where the attackers are using end-to-end encryption on apps to conduct a major terrorist operation. We don't want to see that happen in the United States. Now, in the Garland case, we saw it happen, and it was used. But we want to act in the Congress to prevent that kind of attack from happening in the United States.
Let me just add, first of all, Mike's been a great partner, and I do think with his law enforcement background, my tech background, but we also have overriding the notion that protecting America's national security is paramount. Recognizing, as was recognized by the leading law enforcement and intel figures 2 weeks ago in an open hearing, that encryption is here to stay and protects America's personal information, financial information, intellectual capital, that this is not a battle of security versus privacy. It is a challenge to make security work in a digital environment. Our legislation, which will have 16 members of a commission that will include an ex officio member from the administration that will have a year term, interim report at 6 months, working through process to making sure that it'd be some level of supermajority on recommendations. I think modeled in many ways after the 9/11 commission is, I think, the approach that we ought to be taking. In many ways, the current litigation that's taking place might not have been needed if we'd had this kind of approach a few years back. My fear is that we're talking past each other and that we've seen entities that ought to form some level of collaboration kind of move into an adversarial role. This is not going to get fixed. I know, being back in the wireless and the telecom industry in the 90s, and just the whole notion of the network of the 90s that was a top-down, mostly American-dominated network to now an internet-based, which is all about not top-down, but a distributed network with the cloud, the whole notion of how we get this right that will work not just right now, but on a going-forward basis. I mean, the purpose of the commission is digital security. It is, as the chairman indicated, is much broader than the current issues that are being litigated in court.
I'm glad you brought up the 90s, because that was the era known as the crypto wars by people who were involved with the encryption debate back then. What do you say to people who say that the question before the commission has been asked and answered? There is no way to reconcile end-to-end encryption with what law enforcement wants. And if you do, you're asking for a backdoor into encryption, which will undermine the very security of the internet.
Well, I think, you know, the options before the Congress are, one option is to amend the CLIA statute, which would do exactly what you say, put a backdoor into this phone so the government can get into it, but also the hackers can. And let's not forget that the majority of these apps are overseas outside of our jurisdiction. So, you know, the more you study the issue, the more you realize that would be while it seems like a simple solution, doesn't provide a long-term solution to the problem.
So amending CLIA is off the table.
Now, listen, I think what we're not, we don't think we want to prejudge what the
commission
would do. But the notion, as the mention I made, of the networks that were devised in the 90s and the networks in 2016 and the 2020s are dramatically different, number one. Number two, a static solution which might simply drive smarter criminals and smarter terrorists to foreign-based systems and foreign-based hardware, or even with American hardware or systems that could be, they could personally unlock and then import from the cloud encrypted techniques, isn't going to get it right. That's not a solution set. So part of our challenge here, and as Mike mentioned, you know, there are close to 2,000 additional apps being added to the iTunes store every day. About half of those are foreign-based. Most of them are encrypted. This genie's not going to be put back in the bottle. How do we sort through, at least with common facts, a collaborative technology solution that will, again, even get to, is going to have to include some dialogue around international operating standards so that we don't have an American-only solution?
One thing we do know is that they're not able to sit down and have a dialogue. Who's they? The stakeholders. The FBI, the technology sector, the intelligence community. You know, if the FBI...
Civil liberties and other folks.
Well, and then the privacy advocates. And so this puts, you know, it's a 9/11-style commission to a very... probably the biggest challenge to federal law enforcement I've seen in my lifetime. So I think it's very critically, you know, needed.
Certainly each side knows what the other one thinks. There's not an absence of coverage or debate or even contact between tech companies and the federal government and civil liberties groups who have been very strong in this area. What's actually left to say?
Well, there could be a policy solution or a technology solution. One thing we know for sure, the FBI doesn't have the capability to crack into this phone, the Apple phone. If they had,
as far as we know,
if they had that technology solution, they would do it. Rather, they're asking a private company to build a software to hack into its own device and expose a vulnerability. We think there's a better solution to that. This solution brings all the stakeholders together in the same room.
And I guess, dude, what I would say is I'm not sure I would agree with the premise of your question that everybody knows the full contours of the debate. I can tell you, as somebody who's got some background here, the complexity of this, and for policymakers to sort through getting that common set of facts that a commission would come forward with, common set of recommendations, would be enormously helpful, because this will have to be ultimately decided by Congress. But we have heard the kind of support we've seen, and again, in public hearing, the ODNI saying this kind of discussion is needed. The private conversations we've had with folks from law enforcement, from tech, from civil liberties, all saying, yeah, we need to have this conversation. And candidly, some of the existing reports that have been produced or are being produced have said there is a way through this. I think we just need to get these folks in the room. The challenge will be, and this will probably be your next question, is how do we make sure this commission ends up being acted upon and the results get promulgated into you know, a set of rules that will protect people's privacy, ensure America's security, and allow America's innovative lead to be maintained around the world. And I think that's what we're working through with the stakeholders right now. The model is the 9/11 commission.
Indeed, actually, don't you risk undermining the supremacy of Silicon Valley as a world leader in technology? The world buys American products. Already, our credibility has been damaged following revelations from Edward Snowden. Don't you risk damaging that credibility even more?
Well, there are international standards, I think, that will be at play with this commission. You know, the United States always leads the world, and I think with this commission, the findings will be looked at by China, other countries, by Europe, and I think it will be setting some of the standards. And I don't think, you know, look, we have the support that we've seen for this idea comes not only from the federal law enforcement side privately, but the Cyrus Vances of the world, Manhattan District Attorney, to Apple itself, saying that we need this. We need this commission to have the proper forum and dialogue to resolve these issues.
And I think we, of course, we want to make sure we maintain American innovation. But I think what we want to also do is we got to maintain American security.
Aren't the two synonymous? Isn't having encryption fundamental to having American security?
I think encryption is part of the fabric of American security. I think also making sure we have ways that legally we can go after criminals and terrorists in an appropriate legal fashion is also absolutely necessary to an America in the 21st century. And I feel that having sat through many intel hearings and the chairman through many Homeland Security hearings, I go back to your earlier premise of the question, that we know all the parameters of this debate. I think a commission that is on a tight timeline, modeled after the 9/11 commission, could give us that common set of recommendations that is so necessary.
Debate. Apple supports the commission because it knows that in Washington, D.C., commissions are where controversial issues go to die.
We want to prove them wrong.
Yeah. Well, there was a great Wall Street Journal editorial on this, very supportive of the idea. And they say, you know, usually that's an escape route, but in this case, it's the right thing to do because getting all the relevant players together to have the dialogue under a short time frame that's in the bill is the appropriate way to go, given the complexities of this issue. There's no legislative knee-jerk response right now that will solve this problem. This is the only thing, and we studied this very extensively, it's the only route I see that is solution-oriented. Encryption was designed to create SecureCom. The terrorists have found a way to exploit it to attack us, so we can't see it. So you can't see what they're saying. If they're communicating in darkness, you can't stop it. So this is an urgent issue, and I believe that this is the best vehicle to get to that solution.
And let me just add, you want some real news here? I don't normally agree with the Wall Street Journal editorial page on virtually anything, but this is one I agreed, and I think this is that one-off circumstance. And let's remember, this is not an encryption commission. This is a digital security commission. And it is broader. You know, this is not going to give us all the solution around the challenges of the Internet of Things. That as we think about more and more devices that are going to have sensors on them, thinking ahead of that issue, again, candidly, if we'd had this kind of approach two or three years ago around the subject that is the current debate, we might have had a better solution set. I think our challenge is going to be should this, and I think you'll see broad-based bipartisan support when we announce the legislation, again, hopefully early next week. It'd be also great. We know this is an election year, but this could be a case where we could prove the pundits wrong and actually get something done. I think it's critically important not only for to set this up now, get this commission working. There will be an interim report, but it will also, I think, in many ways, set the table for congressional action, but also for whomever the next administration is going to be.
I wonder if I can ask about the premise of something you just said, Mr. Chairman, and that is that the terrorists are communicating in the dark. We have the metadata, so we know who they're talking to. If they're communicating via SMS, some carriers even retain text messages, not just the metadata, but the actual content, right? How in the dark truly are we, and would having a backdoor into encryption actually reveal something in an investigation that we don't already know? We already know who's talking to who. The communications themselves are almost besides the point.
Well, if you look at case-by-case analysis, right? So the Paris attackers used end-to-end encryption by an app called Telegram. So we can't see that, even with a court order, even with our overseas capabilities. That, because it's encrypted, end-to-end, point-to-point. Now, you may know where the points are, but you can't see the communication itself. So that turned in the United States is a problem. San Bernardino, the phone was backed up to the cloud for many months. We have that. The problem with the current case is that the FBI can't get those last couple months when he turned off the cloud.
But we have from Verizon.
So that's just a hardware issue. You know, asking Apple to break into their own hardware, which they've never done before, design a software program.
But the carrier was Verizon, so we know where the phone was because it's hitting off the cell phone towers. We know who he was calling. We know the content, probably, of the SMS text messages that if he was delivering them. How is that not enough in order to establish whether or not there are sleeper cells inside the United States? Anybody, I assume, who he communicated with in those weeks leading up to the attack has already been contacted.
Well, it's what's in the hardware of the phone months before the attack that was not backed up to the cloud.
And this, again, the Apple case, this commission is much broader than what's currently in the news. And that's going to be litigated through the court system, as it should be. And there are tools, you mentioned metadata, that are available now under appropriate circumstances that can be used. But there will be some tension here of how do you drill down to the specifics of an individual content of a communication versus the challenges around our other basic constitutional rights around privacy. I do think there may be technological tools and technological ways within a legal structure that we can have a better solution set than we've got right now, where people have retreated to their corners on an adversarial basis.
I want to make sure to leave time for audience questions. Sir.
Hi there. I'm a reporter with BuzzFeed News. My name is Hamza Shaban. My question is for you, Senator. Earlier you said that ultimately encryption should be an issue that's settled by Congress. So I'm wondering, do you think that the Justice Department should withdraw its motion to compel against Apple?
No. I think that case is going to be played out. And what I said was digital security is going to have to be, that issue is going to have to be determined by Congress. Okay. I believe in open hearing, the head of the NSA, Director Comey, Admiral Rogers, I believe Director Comey, I believe the head of our national intelligence, Director Clapper, who've all said, in effect, encryption is here to stay, and encryption helps protect the security of Americans. So as much as some may want to turn this into a debate over encryption, when this is a debate about digital security that I think Congress is going to have to weigh in. But in the meantime, this court proceeding will go forward.
And Chairman McCaul, Senator Feinstein said that if Apple does not comply, she will put forth legislation that would make them comply. And I'm wondering, is that the kind of knee-jerk legislation that you were talking about earlier that we don't need right now?
Well, I don't know what the Burr-Feinstein bill is at this point in time, so it'd be premature for me to comment on that. I do know there are some more punitive measures against industry to make them comply. And the argument, of course, with Apple is they don't have the capability currently to get into that system. Now, that can be debated. They say they have to develop a software program to hack into their own system, thereby exposing a vulnerability. So you can see the complexity of all these issues. From the tech perspective, I see it as a former federal prosecutor, I see this very strongly also from the FBI's perspective, that you got a court order, you got a dead terrorist phone, and you ought to be able to open it up. And I think that demonstrates the need for what we're talking about, is that we get one perspective from tech, we get another one from the FBI and Justice, who I served for many years under. The point is, there's no simple solution here, and that's why we need the experts.
And what we don't want to do, I think, is end up with a static solution that may be a short-term fix that pushes people to foreign-based technology or being able to still bring down from the cloud or elsewhere tools that we've not fully thought through. We got to think about the smart terrorists and the smart criminals.
So let's do it like this. Let's do here, and then you, sir, and then in the back, in that order.
Hi, Stacey O'Mara with Bloomberg Government. I'm just wondering if you could tell me, when will the commission make its first set of recommendations? When will those be due?
Well, we got to pass the bill first.
Well, how long will that take? And then also, what will the stakeholders look like? Will you have representatives from industry as well?
Yeah. I mean, timing, I think we introduce it next week. I predict it gets a lot of momentum to an urgent situation. I do believe the administration will be supportive, and I think this thing gets fast-tracked. 6-month reporting requirement, preliminary, and the full report in 1 year. And the stakeholders are, you know, everything from Silicon Valley to the FBI to the intelligence community to the privacy advocates to encryption
cryptologists,
experts.
Cryptologists, yeah. Local law enforcement. The makeup of these commissions, especially in an area that's as complex as this, we've taken our best stab at it. There may be others who can. I think neither of us are wedded. We're wedded to getting the right people at the table in a way that can deliver a report that would have some level of supermajority, so that each group had their views included in a set of recommendations. And I think, again, the 9/11 Commission is the model. And the challenge for us is to make clear that this is going to lead to a set of recommendations that will be factually based that Congress can then act on. And that's what I think we've been missing so far.
Yes, this is Tom Risen with U.S. News and World Report. I like how you mentioned the crypto wars. As a former prosecutor and a former tech entrepreneur, in 99, the Court of Appeals ruled that code is a form of speech. What do you think of the argument that compelling someone to write code is a free speech issue?
Well, you know, let me answer that first, because you probably have a better answer. I went to law school but never practiced law, so I don't ever want to weigh in on kind of court decisions. So.
Well, the decision was made in 99 that code is free speech.
Yeah. It goes to the fact that I've studied this for the last year. I get calls from the FBI about this issue. I talked to the Secretary of Homeland Security. I had hearings on this. I'm a friend of the tech community. I chair the High Tech Caucus as well. So I'm sort of in a unique position, just like the senator. And what I found was that there is no easy, knee-jerk legislative response to this. Amending CLIA is not going to solve the problem. And more than half these companies are overseas anyway. A punitive measure against industry, I'm not sure that's going to be the right answer. And it will hurt our economy and our international business. So,
and it may not make us safer.
And it may, and that's the thing. If you make it safer, perhaps it's because of that complexity. And as I've stated, there is no easy, knee-jerk legislative response at this time, which is why I'm not a big commission guy either. I was skeptical myself, but this is, in my judgment, the best response. And the fact of the matter is, if Congress does nothing, as some would advocate, that we do nothing on this issue, and we get hit in the United States with a Paris-style attack, I don't want that on my hands.
And I think, again, this is an issue that, frankly, to be left to individual courts around the nation and then have it perk through the whole process where you might have conflicting opinions based on the district, I think Congress got a responsibility to weigh in. But I think the notion right now, when you've got so many conflicting sets of facts coming at you, and I say this as a tech guy, you can go down a lot of rabbit holes on what if you do this and this happens, that the debate would be at a much higher, better caliber if we have this activity.
And I'd rather hear from the experts rather than, believe it or not, Congress, we're not always the experts. We think we know all the
Shocking.
Policy, we have all the answers, but particularly in an issue as technical as this one, we don't have the answers.
And you mentioned there are, Jim's going to mention this in, maybe in the next panel. There are clear Fourth Amendment issues. There are Fifth Amendment issues. I was listening to a radio program yesterday. Somebody was making a 13th Amendment argument. Can you force a company to produce labor? So there, you know, the more we can sort this out, the better. Let's take a couple more.
In the back.
Morgan Reed with the App Association. I wanted to say, first of all, thank you for recognizing that that this encryption is used to protect health and financial and very personal information for millions of Americans. But the vast majority of these apps are not actually built by large traditional software companies out of Silicon Valley. In fact, they're built by small businesses throughout the United States. How do you see this commission engaging with these critical U.S. businesses?
I think that goes to the heart of how do you get a commission that represents all voices. And you see our legislation, you'll see our attempt at balancing that. But I imagine that'll be somewhat of, that'll be the subject of part of the debate. Getting the mix right makes the recommendations, will make the recommendations better, which will make it more more required that we then take those recommendations and don't leave them on the shelf. But that's going to be part of the challenge in getting this right going forward. And I'm sure you and others will weigh in when you see the legislation next week.
I think we have time for one more.
Max,
let's get the microphone to you.
Max Rosenthal from, is this on? Oh, yeah. Max Rosenthal from Mother Jones. As you both said, there's been a lot of agreement about the need for a commission, but there's been very little about what policy proposals may go into that or may come out of it. Can either you, Chairman McCall, or Senator Warner, talk about any specific policy proposals, ideas, or maybe ways in which other countries or jurisdictions have handled this problem that you're going to bring into the commission or you use as a model for what might come out of it?
We have, I think China, Europe, look to the United States to take the lead on a lot of these issues. This will have an international component to it, as it should. But I think the bottom line, the dilemma we face right now is this end-to-end encryption apps that we can't see, that going back to Paris and Garland, and how can we, even if we have a court order, see those communications, while at the same time not violating, the security interest of encryption itself, which protects Americans and protects their private data. And it's that balance of security versus security that we're looking at to get the experts together to provide the solutions.
I think we're already seeing other countries try to move into this space, what Russia's trying to do right now, which is a very much would lead to the balkanization of the internet, which I think would be bad for America, bad for the world. I think we've seen some of these issues play out already in the UK, where part of this debate was raging with the Cameron government. I think increasingly you're going to see European entities. So I think we have to look at what would be and not just an American only, but ultimately something that could set a template on operating systems for the world, number one. Number two, I think we want to keep stressing we've got the immediate challenge around end-to-end encryption. But this is, again, it was just that topic. This would be an encryption commission. It's not. It's a digital security commission. There is going to be a whole new wave of challenges as we think about more and more devices that we use in our daily life that are going to be connected to the network, the whole Internet of Things. Can we not only grapple with what we've got right now, that will be litigated through the courts, but can we at least get some guideposts as where we're headed? That's a big, I don't want to make that something that's got to solve every problem in the world, but I think the notion of getting these folks working together, the time is now. We see the fact that this has not taken place. We see this debate, I'm not sure, had to end up in the adversarial place it is right now. There are tensions. We want to, I guess my closing comment is, we want to maintain American innovation. We want to maintain America's privacy rights. We also definitely want to make sure that Americans are safe from acts of terror and criminal acts. And with all of the advantages that the digital world has brought, it's brought us a whole series of vulnerabilities where, candidly, our adversaries, it's an asymmetrical relationship, the ability for our adversaries to use the digital world that we live in ways to hurt us or take advantage of our personal information or our intellectual capital. This is kind of a little unprecedented. So, boy, if there was ever a time to try to get it right and not to default this to a Democrat-Republican debate, this is the issue.
And it's like just, you know, technology has evolved way in front of policymakers and the law. And this commission is a great exercise in education for policymakers on what the solutions are to these problems that we have.
And we're looking forward to this, the next group who's going to help maybe give more specificity to the questions you just asked.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Please join me. Thank you for staying for the second panel. So from left to right, we have Chris Inglis, formerly of the National Security Agency. We have Susan Hennessy. We have Jim Lewis. And we have Michael German. And there's additional details in you know, I don't have to go through their bios. Everybody knows them. Where should we begin, panel? Is the idea of a commission in order to solve the problem actually feasible? It's the same question I think I started off the first panel with. Aren't contours of the debate known and answered? Is there actually any solution that has yet to be proposed that we don't already know of?
So I'll start. I do think that there's utility to this kind of commission. And essentially, it's not the utility of developing new facts. It's about having a conversation that invites a more pragmatic view and maybe leaves some of the ideological positions behind. And so certainly we are well aware of sort of the, you know, the more strident or ideological leanings of people in Silicon Valley, people in the government. If this commission is an opportunity to take a more problem-solving approach to the problem.
Are they ideological leanings or are they basic facts of technology and encryption?
So I think that presenting the entire issue as a single basic fact of technology and encryption is itself a little bit of an ideological trick, right? It's saying, for example, in the Apple case, there are many that would argue that it actually doesn't implicate encryption in quite the way that it's being presented, right? It's not the back door, it's the front door. And so I don't know that it's sort of obvious what the ultimate outcome is, but getting people in a room who are willing to, as a matter of first principle, believe that there might be a solution, I think represents a step forward than sort of saying, if the position here is any access for law enforcement, any access for the government whatsoever, is in and of itself, as a matter of principle, a backdoor that allows criminal access and is therefore unacceptable, it's really hard to have sort of a meaningful policy conversation, let alone constructive legislation that comes out of that.
But I, too, think the commission's a great idea. I agree with everything Susan's just said, but would offer. Though I think oftentimes we start with a solution and we try to beat it up to see whether it meets our respective interest. I don't think that's the right way. As I heard Senator Warner, Congresswoman McCall, we need to start with some principles and determine whether we have a collective objective. There are at least three distinguished interests on the table. That security pursued by individuals, that security that is desired by collections of individuals, possibly nation states, organizations, or societies that cross national boundaries. And then finally, the economic vitality that is sought by companies that are pursuing their aspirations in this space. Those seem to be in conflict in the digital age. And we need to start first and foremost with what do we mean by security in the digital age. If we agree on what that looks like, what that feels like, we can then examine solutions against that criterion. We've worked at just the opposite. I think the commission's a great idea.
We need a mechanism to get to an answer. This is not an insoluble problem. I think, as both of my colleagues have said, there is an answer. We need a mechanism that will help us get to it. It's largely a political issue for me. People have to make decisions about, you know, if there's a range, and if the range to simplify is yes and no, the right answer is somewhere in between. But where we put that line is very much a political consideration.
And I'm a big fan of education and debate, so having more debate, I think, is certainly going to be helpful. I think there's so much hyperbole and misinformation in the public debate so far and the way it's been waged. As somebody who spent the bulk of my FBI career in the pre-technology age, which for the FBI was till about 2007, even the concept of this going dark so misrepresents the bulk of information that the FBI and other law enforcement agencies currently have about all of us, about where we are, about who we're talking to. So the idea that if there's one piece of data out there that the government can't get, that is going to destroy our entire national security is simply specious. And I think it's important also that when we have a commission like this, we're full of commissions here in D.C., that we actually listen to what their recommendations are. And there actually was an executive branch commission on this very issue, the President's Review Group for Intelligence Activities. And they, like Chairman McCaul and Senator Warner, looked at this as a security versus security, that this wasn't privacy versus security, and that a free and open internet is critical to both open government and economic growth. But their recommendation was the U.S. government should take additional steps to promote security by, one, fully supporting and not undermining efforts to create encryption standards. Two, making it clear that it will not in any way subvert, undermine, weaken, or make vulnerable generally available commercial encryption. And three, supporting efforts to encourage the greatest use of encryption technology for data in transit, at rest, in the cloud, and in storage. Obviously, the executive branch has not heeded these recommendations, and that's why.
But we can help the debate here by saying, don't say backdoor, please. I mean, backdoor is just something that people made up as a pejorative term to influence the debate. The debate is between end-to-end and recoverable plain text. Okay? So say recoverable. Don't say backdoor. Do me a favor.
And also to recognize that there's no such thing as a 100% solution. There is always going to be information that law enforcement and intelligence can't access. And there's always going to be information that law enforcement and intelligence can access. The whole process is about balancing sort of the appropriate limitations on the government as they carry out their respective missions, and also the incumbent obligations on U.S. corporations and U.S. citizens as they as we sort of find the right balance there.
Why haven't we already arrived at that balance? As Michael mentioned, the government already collects plenty of data about us, who we're talking to, just by looking at what one phone is calling another phone. Again, I alluded to the fact that there's even sometimes content wrapped up in what we would ordinarily consider metadata. As Michael Hayden said, we kill people based on metadata is an extremely powerful tool for finding out networks of people, for finding out what they're doing. Aren't we at a balance already?
I think you're mixing a lot of streams here. When Michael Hayden says we kill people based upon metadata, presumably those are done according to the rule of law and that those are persons who are at war with the United States. That's a different matter than what is happening right now with respect to the tete-a-tete vis-a-vis FBI and Apple. We're talking about a U.S. person, right, whose phone is in the possession of the FBI, and they need help understanding what's on that so that they might then pursue a criminal, possibly a terrorist investigation. But we can argue as to whether there's a lot of data already available to cover that waterfront. But that's the nice thing about the commission. All sides that enter into that will go in believing that their position will be affirmed. And my bet is they're going to be shocked, stunned, and amazed when they get into the room to realize that it's complicated, that there are different views, and that if they're charged properly, they'll have to reconcile those views inside that room and come out with something that they would collectively recommend that covers the waterfront of all those distinguished interests. And so I would leave terms like specious and dragnet and backdoor and heavy-handed off the table and say, let's go in and see if we can't solve this problem from a principled perspective and drive engineering to our purpose.
Chris and I are both survivors of the crypto war of the 90s. I think I was subpoenaed by the Ninth Circuit on that CODIS free speech thing. And one of the things that I think Senator Warner said, Chairman McCaul said that's exactly right, is this is a dynamic situation. We did come up with a solution in 1999 and 2000, and you know what? It's not the same world. It's not the same industry. The internet back then was really kind of an auxiliary, kind of a toy. It wasn't the central infrastructure. So we need to rethink the status quo that we came up with at this point 16 years ago. It doesn't fit the world anymore.
Arguably, the importance of having privacy as the internet has become more ubiquitous, more pervasive everywhere, has only grown more important. Our ability to actually use these devices and put our lives into them depends on our ability to know that it is indeed private.
But privacy has never become less important, but it always was something that contended on occasion with the need of society to understand, are you going to use that privacy as an instrument of harm against the larger society? The existence of the Fourth Amendment, which I would observe is even older than the All Writs Act, the existence of the Fourth Amendment would say not that privacy is an absolute, but that there is a very high bar necessary for government to intrude upon that privacy. That adjudication, that reconciliation, we've understood generation upon generation, is hard to achieve. There's a probable cause standard, but the application of that to either procedure or technology has evolved over time. I think what we're asking is there a further evolution that would allow us to achieve that reconciliation? It may be that in this time and day, in a digital age, it's too hard for us to actually pursue it. I'm not sure that we've answered that question.
I think it also presents sort of a fundamental question, which is we have mechanisms to determine the appropriate scopes of privacy. Do we want the line to be dictated by technology, or do we want the line to be dictated by the law? So in the situation we're currently seeing, technology is exceeding the law. That might be good or bad from a technology standpoint, and we might have a robust security discussion about sort of that it's time to rethink where those lines belong. But the fundamental question here is really whose job it is to determine kind of what the scope of lawful access looks like. I would posit, sort of being candid, in my personal opinion, that is a job for the legislature and not a job for technology companies. Which is why I think processes like the commission can be important, because of course that technology company voice is so important. It's important as an educational matter, and they have a right to advocate. They have serious equities here, but that sort of that technological equity, we have not sort of understood that to be the mechanism that determines what law enforcement access looks like and what law enforcement access looks like.
And I think that touches one of the major difficulties with putting any commission like this together, which is that the law, as we understand it in the public, often is not the law as it's being applied by intelligence agencies, that there are secret reinterpretations of the law that change the nature of our rights. And so when a commission like this gets together, obviously they need access to that information, but the way a democracy works is based on popular information. And without popular information by which we all can make these decisions and evaluate the arguments on either side, we need to know the scope of all the activities taking place and not necessarily the intricate details that are necessary to keep cleared for security reasons, but certainly the scope of the law should be something that all Americans understand as this debate goes on.
So, Mike, I agree with the assertion. I'm not sure I agree with the conclusion, right, that the government has necessarily played fast and loose, but I think that's why the commission has been characterized as something that must necessarily involve privacy interest, right, that there are going to have to be some folks there that actually ask that question and hold the commission to that account.
But the public needs a voice in it as well. We can't have people go behind
the commission isn't going to have 315 million people on it.
No. But they need to have public hearings, and they need to have the availability of information. They can write classified information to release. There's a number of ways that we deal with classified information in public setting, in criminal courts and in other things that we have to apply to any kind of
To that end, I think we would probably agree that the best possible result of the commission would be something that is fully readable by anyone, not just in this country, but broadly upon others that we would choose to influence in the world.
And that's where I think something that Senator Warner and Chairman McCall said that was really important and probably deserves a little more attention, and that is this is a commission on digital security. And we tend to put things in these antique stovepipe security privacy. The issue is larger than that, and we need to rethink it in this broader term. The part that I worry about is you could have a solution that you could say NSA and FBI are bad, we're putting them in a box, and that would not make the world happy. The world is unhappy with American agencies. They're also unhappy with American companies because of the perceived lack of privacy. That's one reason why the Europeans spend so much time chasing tech companies around with a butterfly net. the general unhappiness with the level of privacy as it's perceived, I don't know if it's true, but as it's perceived is going to drive this. And we need a solution that addresses not only the agency problems, but the commercial problems as well.
So diving into the work of the commission. So there was a talk from the two representatives about having to have an international dimension. Because, of course, if you have an end-to-end encrypted app that's coded overseas, there's no American law that can touch them. What kind of hope does the commission actually have for establishing international standards that would be adhered to and adhered to universally, or at least enough, such that whatever standards they come up with would actually have a meaningful impact on the market?
Well, it's likely not to have international standing, but it could have international influence. It has to first understand the lay of the land and understand the expectations, aspirations of other, potentially start with like-minded nations, but you have to understand kind of all nations. And in the context of that, come up with something that's likely to achieve the influence that we would prefer. You might achieve that influence through market forces. You might achieve that by appealing to the common values, the common foundations of those values across the globe. Having not run the commission, we don't yet know what choice they might make, but they have to consider it in an international context. Because it's not going to work if it's U.S. only.
And, you know, we're doing a little research on this to look at what are other countries thinking. And if just off the top of my head, Russia, China, many countries in the European Union, not Germany, but most of the others, India, all are either putting in place or have in place restrictions on end-to-end encryption. So we don't want to think of a solution that makes us happy here and it's not going to make the rest of the world happy because they'll move out without us. Right? So we need something that can address the concerns shared by many nations. And I think there's a way to do that, and that's where the commission could be helpful.
And I think one of the things that's really important is also maintaining our commitment to democracy abroad. I mean, one of the issues that doesn't get discussed enough in this privacy versus security is that our foreign policy and national security is dependent a lot on what goes on abroad. And we want to make sure that, that human rights activists in the worst countries in the world have a voice and can get the information out, that political dissidents everywhere can be protected in their anonymity when they're communicating not just with the world but with our intelligence agencies. I mean, this is the internet and this new technology is something that can be a very educational and democratizing force if we let it be, but it needs to be secure in order for us to allow that to happen.
But even the conversation about sort of the international dimension is becoming sort of grossly oversimplified. Not only are there a lot of different countries with a lot of different sort of values, so one of sort of the discussions that's emerging from the Apple debate, for example, is that by allowing U.S. technology companies to essentially create conditions such that they can't, nobody can give data access, and that's the end of the story, we're going to be able to protect these dissident communications abroad. You know, for example, Apple has sort of asserted that they've had a little bit of success in China, with draft legislation there. This is a complex discussion, right? Certainly the Chinese government is not sitting with bated breath waiting to find out if the Central District of California agrees that the All Writs Act applies in this sort of one situation, right? These are national policies that are set at the highest levels of those countries. That said, they are certainly watching. Certainly it changes tech companies' negotiating postures. So while I wholly support the notion that we need to incorporate these equities, we need to consider these equities, they're more complex than just, well, we're going to create something that no one else is going to be able to get into, and then we're going to be able to enter the markets worldwide regardless of what their laws look like, and that'll sort of be the end of the story.
How so? If a coder in a country that doesn't agree, that isn't going through this debate the same way we are, say Germany, decides to have an end-to-end encrypted app and not comply with whatever standards that this commission would recommend or subsequent standards that are adopted, what's to prevent users from downloading that app or using open source technology, for that matter, which would not be governed by these standards in order to have secure encryption.
Right, so this already gets to the complexity of the conversation, right? So the difference between a major technology company, the operating system sort of underlying the phone, versus these third-party applications and the difficulties involved in governing that space. Again, I think it's important to just be candid that there isn't a 100% solution, that it's always going to be possible for two people who are careful and committed and smart to have a conversation that nobody can intercept. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. The question is whether or not the proliferation of that technology as sort of as a default standard is appropriate.
My experience is a little limited, but in the countries I know about, like China, generally if you use end-to-end encryption, you're flagging yourself as a target for the security services. And so, yeah, they won't read your communications, but they'll come and arrest you. So your choice. Let's not overstate the value of this stuff.
But I think it's very important still. I mean, certainly anything that the U.S. does is going to be the floor, not the ceiling, for what other countries do. So not only will it have an impact, and not only are they watching for that impact, but the companies that are now producing more privacy-protective technologies are doing that for a reason, is because there's a market demand for it. And if there's a demand for it, and some of it, I think, from the Snowden revelations, somebody is going to meet that demand. We can't stop heroin from getting into our country because there's a demand for heroin in our country. So the idea that we're going to stop encryption by coercing the big companies to play will create a situation in which law-abiding people can't use strong encryption, but the criminals still have access to it.
But I heard no mention of coercion in this discussion.
This is
intended to be a thoughtful discussion of how do you reconcile these great goods, at least three great goods on the table. And the question is, how do we put and into the conversation as opposed to or?
And that's why it's a political thing. Countries will have to decide what the U.S. will do will be precedential, although I think the days when we could set the standards are coming to an end. We'll need some sort of multilateral solution. But societies can decide this much for privacy, this much for security. Draw the line somewhere. It's a political decision. And it will not be either or. It will not be FBI has access to everything. It will not be Apple can do whatever it wants. It will be somewhere in between.
Another aspect of the international question that's been alluded to is the fact that, of course, if we set it up, or technology companies in the U.S., U.S. technology companies are forced somehow into additional cooperation with law enforcement that they don't want to give, it's not a leap to say that they will be likewise forced to do so in oppressive countries like China. The list of horribles goes on, right?
I don't think it's a leap to say that independent of what the U.S. does, that they will likely be forced in various countries to do something that they might not prefer to do. So the United States can either ignore that, put its head in the sand, or understand that and influence that. And if we have a formulation that we would prefer, it's our obligation, not just for our people, but for what we believe would be like-minded nations, to try to advance that through any variety of mechanisms. We might do that through diplomacy. We might do that through market forces. We might do that simply by leading by best practice. But absent the conversation that is proposed by Senator Warner and Congressman McCaul, we at this moment in time continue to speak past one another.
Because the U.S. is the floor, not the ceiling of...
I don't know that I know where the floor or the ceiling is. I have no idea. You know,
but if there was a
free fall...
Yeah, if there was a floor, there'd be a trap door.
That's right. So. But not a back one.
Right, and also to understand that Apple's sort of equities are look different than other technology companies, right? So companies like Google, that access to data is a different part of their business model, not just for sort of evil advertising purposes, but also in order to provide services, in order to sort of, in order to be usable, they require insight into data. And so to sort of demonize the concept that a company maintaining access to data is like necessarily a bad thing, that really does demonize a very large portion of the technology sector that would say, wait a minute, just because we allow access pursuant to our business model, and just because we allow access pursuant to legal process in a given country, doesn't mean that we're evildoers worldwide.
But I would hope this commission is set up, or whatever commissions follow it, are set up to explore those problems, because part of the problem is that the public doesn't really have a good sense of what these companies are doing with their information, and they deserve to have that. And the power dimension between the public using this material and the companies that produce it is very unbalanced.
I understand the point of the commission is to have a debate, but there's also been a lot of talk about the solutions that they could come up with. Can somebody actually elucidate a solution?
We wouldn't need a commission.
Right. We'll come in. I mean, look, so I don't think that we need to do anything revolutionary here. I think people are sort of acting as though there needs to be this brand new solution that nobody's ever thought of. We have a pretty good process. And that process is that technology companies are allowed to develop their products. They should do so both sort of in service of their business equities and their security equities, and they should determine what's appropriate. Then based on those decisions that they get to make pursuant to the law, but sort of freely, they are obligated to provide particular types of technical assistance to the government. Now, that technical assistance has to be within their capabilities. It has to fall within sort of the balancing test that we've incorporated into the law. But there should be some obligation to do what you can to effectuate legal process. And this is not revolutionary. There are technical assistance.
Hasn't Apple, for example, already exactly done that in the case of the San Bernardino shooter's iPhone? They provided the iPhone iCloud backup.
But that's not the extent of the capability, right? Apple has essentially conceded the notion that they do have the capability to write the code, essentially to bypass this locking mechanism. Now, that doesn't mean that the law can require them to do that. That's for a federal judge to decide. I think a little bit of what we're the overlapping tension here is what's happening in the California case is, well, this law is now getting stretched. This is essentially, it's supposed to be sort of a gap filler. We're moving into a space where it feels uncomfortable. That speaks not to the idea that the law doesn't apply properly there, but to the notion that now the American people feel like there is a need for a new law. That law might say company shall do X or no company shall ever do X, right? That's for Congress to decide. But I think sort of the fundamental notion here that somehow the loudest voice in the room gets to decide or a corporation gets to decide or even that the FBI gets to decide, it's really sort of ignoring the fundamental process as it's supposed to work.
And the only thing, if you don't mind, I mean, I think what the President's Review Group came up with was a pretty good solution. But to the point about, one of the reasons why I really think the commission is a good idea is because I'm concerned about the idea of district court judges making these decisions based on very narrow facts, either perhaps not understanding the technology, but also not being able to bring in all these other factors that we've been discussing about foreign policy and other security interests and those kinds of issues into their decision making when they're moving in a case by case basis. And certainly the worst thing would be a number of different circuits having completely different opinions about what rules govern what services and technologies that would create a balkanized system right within the United States.
Chris.
To your question about does anybody have a solution, I do, but I wouldn't put it on the table at this moment in time because I don't know that we know how to grade it, right? And my bet is that the commission needs to start in a completely different place than a solution and first try to figure out, and again, taking Mike's point, which I think is quite right, I'm taking the broadest possible survey of the various constituencies, plural, that are involved in this, whether it's international, whether it's different constituencies within the U.S., kind of through the lens of the private sector, through the lens of the individual, through the lens of the government, through the lens of even distinguished interest within the government, and having done that, reconcile what are the values that we're pursuing here, right? And once that's on the table, hopefully the commission will agree this is what we're trying to pursue in a perfect world, right? Now, engineering-wise, it's always impossible to pursue the perfect implementation of that, but at least you've got something to score the homework. And beyond that, then figure out what the transparency of that solution needs to be, what the due process attendant to that solution needs to be, what the international interest in that solution needs to be, and then and only then are you prepared to begin to put some different solutions on the table to say, well, would this work? Would this not work? But I think if we go too quickly to the solution space, we'll be right where we are today, which is screaming past one another.
And I'm pretty confident that the tech companies can come up with products and services that will take care of the problem, right? Maybe not 100%, but I'm pretty confident that if a group like this commission can set the guidelines or the principles that they should build to, that they'll be able to do it. So I think there is a solution out there. We need a process to get to it, and that's where the commission can be helpful.
I have to ask this because so many cryptologists say when asked that question, certainly if we have enough brain power in one room, there can be a solution. Their answer is no. At what point do we take their word for it?
Well, I know many of them, and they would say that it's not impossible to say it's very hard and probably so hard that it would exceed our ability to do that with the kind of perfection you would prefer. But if the charge at the end of the day is, but we must, that's a different charge, that's a different question. We then could find solutions that we might just get close enough. I would tell you that if you said, let's write off all other interest except the ability of two individuals on the planet to communicate securely, absolutely securely, that's an impossible goal in and of itself. There's not enough money to do that such that it's perfect. And so we're going to always wind up short of our goal. We need to set the right goal and then figure out how we actually optimize the assets against that, which include not just technology, but procedure and accountability. Right? All of those things need to be in the package.
Audience questions. I ignored this side of the room last time, so.
Got a couple over there.
We have one there, and we'll get more.
Hi, my name's Elias Grohl. I'm a reporter for Foreign Policy. This is a question for Mr. Inglis. I'm wondering if you can elaborate on your comments about cryptographers. One leading cryptographer who I spoke to recently said that it's something of a paradox to build something that's secure until you want it not to be secure. What is it that you have in mind when you speak of these cryptographers who think that, yeah, it's very hard, but that this circle can somehow be squared? Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Depending upon your implementation choice, you're trying to build a global system that essentially allows two parties to communicate with high confidence that no one else can get access to that. You can build it so that that's absolute. You could build it such that your business model is as a third party to actually read the content of everything that transpires between the two of them for your business purposes so that you might then understand what they're interested in and advertise to them. To understand that there are, in fact, companies who've made each of those choices, and we've not declared either one of those architectures to be a sin against humanity. And so I think that there is, by simply the illustrative examples before us, many ways to do this. You can choose one or the other of those depending upon what your business imperatives are.
And the cryptographers aren't, they have a political agenda, and they have followed the same agenda now for about 20 years. So it's not like you're getting pure technical advice. They're good and they're smart and they point to important problems, but they do have a goal in mind. And the report that came out of MIT, what was it, like 20 age cryptographers opine on something or other, I forgot what the title was. It was almost a replay of what they wrote in the mid-90s. So there's an objective here. This is part. That's why a truly balanced commission with all the voices in the room, including those cryptographers, but also with people who maybe have slightly different goals, would be useful.
I think even sort of the more honest brokers of every community, it's important to know what they're talking about, right? So I think that there are a lot of cryptographers who would sort of say, yes, you cannot alter cryptographic standards in such a way, right? That's different than what's being asked in San Bernardino. That's different than solutions like device hacking, right? There are a lot of options on the table, and so it's a question of framing, right? So if they're speaking about sort of pure cryptography, yes, they might sort of be loyal to a little bit more of an absolutist position. Whenever you open up the framing to say, okay, what are the mechanisms around it by which we preserve sort of what's most important to you, I think you can get somewhere. The problem is whenever you frame the question of the back door as any access whatsoever is therefore a vulnerability, and it certainly is theoretically, right? We understand that. The practical sort of risk of that vulnerability is more complex. But whenever you frame it in those absolutist terms, I think that's what causes people to sort of disengage from a productive conversation because that's a matter of first principle. If there's no way to do this safely, if the value is 100% security and law enforcement access of any type is threatens that value, it's hard to know what a good solution might look like.
Although I think part of the problem is the government's attitude towards data is different than it has been for any other type of evidence, right? There have been all kinds of different technologies that have destroyed evidence, right? We allow paper shredders to exist. We don't require the people who manufacture paper shredders to have a chip that actually records and scans that document so it's recoverable by the government. The piece of technology that has destroyed more evidence than any other, I'm sure every law enforcement officer agree, it's the flush toilet. And yet we realize the benefits of indoor plumbing to our society outweigh the fact that certain evidence is going to be beyond the government's reach. And that applies to terrorism cases. Najibullah Zazi, who traveled overseas to terrorist training camps, came back with a recipe to make bombs, made that bomb, brought 2 pounds of explosives to New York City to put on the subway. When he realized the gig was up, he flushed it down the toilet. And had he not confessed to that, the government never would have known that that material had been created. So, you know, I think we have to take a step back and realize we live in a society of limited government. And that is how we have chosen to govern ourselves. And it's a very important principle that we make sure we're holding government to that, even in this new technological world.
Just to add one quick thing to that, because I think that's right. We ought to recognize there's no such thing as unbreakable cryptography. Anything that man builds, man can break. And it might take more money, it might take more effort, it might take a little ingenuity. We had unbreakable encryption in the past, and our opponents traduced the crypto clerks. There's a lot of solutions, but you're never going to have perfect security, you're never going to have perfect cryptography. So we need to start reframing the debate to be a little more accurate on these points. You know, no back doors, sure. Perfect cryptography, not possible. Well, let's see if we can interject some facts into this.
Sir.
Hello, my name is David Forsey from Third Way. I'd like to touch on something Mr. Lewis just raised, which is there is no unbreakable encryption. We know that intelligence agencies have broken encryption, and from what I've seen over the past couple of years, the law enforcement community seems to have been far more vocal in their issues with encryption. Mr. Clapper, Director DNI Clapper, has talked about it recently, but Mr. Rogers also said, look, we're talking about the wrong issues, we should just let it happen. So could you talk a little bit about the apparent split, if there is any, between law enforcement and intelligence?
I think most of it is more PR than anything else. I think, you know, these agencies work hand in glove today, and I think everybody has just realized that the credibility that the NSA has on this issue is very much damaged by the Edward Snowden leaks, and the FBI has the cleanest argument that they think the public will acquiesce to, which is this idea only with a warrant. But that's what George Bush said when he was running for office in 2004, that when we're talking wiretaps, we're talking warrants, but of course they weren't.
So I'm sure Chris will speak to this as well. It's a stretch to say that this is just sort of a calculated PR move. There's not a monolithic interest within the United States government, nor should there be, right? Each agency has a lawfully committed mission. They should be conducting those lawfully committed missions and not the missions of other people. While certainly there is a need for communication among law enforcement, there's certainly some community of interest with the law enforcement and intelligence community. These are two separate parts of the government. They're separate parts of the Constitution. These are not the notion here that the NSA should be leading the charge on what is essentially a law enforcement equity, right? Because this is really a problem for law enforcement because there are more ordinary crimes than crimes of terrorism.
Susan said that very well. First, I would say that with respect to the allegations of Mr. Snowden, they're not one and the same as revelations, and so we need to reset the facts. But second, I would say that the authorities, as Susan indicated, of the National Security Agency and the Federal Bureau of Investigation are different. They're distinguished authorities. They may use oftentimes the same techniques, but I don't think you want the same relationship between the FBI and the private sector within the United States that NSA might have with some entity operating north of Pyongyang, North Korea. You know, I don't think you want the private sector saying to the FBI, beat me if you can. If there is a collaborative arrangement that allows us to essentially at once protect the distinguished interest of individuals and collections of individuals and the vitality of a private sector, we ought to find that and we ought to do that such that everyone understands precisely how that works.
In the back.
This is as much comment as question. One of the things that I've heard all of you mention is technology companies will X. And earlier references to Kalia. One of the problems that we face in this space is that the explosion of mobile apps on these platforms is not defined by a narrow subset of companies and vendors that we found when we all worked on Kalia. And so how do you impose even rules that you might say that Apple agrees to when you realize that it's five guys in Iowa building a mobile application completely innocently to allow two-way communications or to post funny anonymous pictures on the web so that you don't have to put in private information? So I caution that Kalia sense of finding a chokehold that we did with Kalia around specific vendors and the tiny number of monopoly companies that operated at the time. When you're looking at a space that literally has 1.5 million apps and hundreds of thousands of independent companies throughout the world creating products. And so I'd welcome your input, but that's the one area I think we have to be very careful about.
We all talked to Senator Warner and Chairman McCall before we came out, before they talked, and they know Kalia isn't the model. Mm-hmm. Kalia is, when is it from? It's
94.
Yeah, it's really old. So it's nice, I like it a lot, but everyone knows it's not the solution. The idea, though, that you can find ways for the private sector and the government to work together, whether it's through standards or legislation or something else, I think that's the model. So Kalia, you know, it's wonderful, but it's not the model.
Right.
Go ahead. I would just argue that we don't want those standards to be so high that it's pushing innovation overseas to countries where the standards might be different.
Look, the government is going to have to accept some degree of risk, and ultimately it's for the American people to determine sort of the appropriate risk. Anyone in the government who tells you that they can pass a law that gives 100% solution is selling you something, right? That's not accurate. That said, I think there are even strategic reasons, right? So if you have an adversary and the adversary is, say, a terrorist organization or just a drug dealer in the United States, and they have to choose among 500,000 apps, those aren't all created alike, right? So there are forcing functions. There are resource allocation reasons. I think that the idea that we can't get to 100% solution doesn't mean that the right answer is just sort of throw up our hands and say, well, if we can't fix everything, I guess we fix nothing, and let's just like head home. I think that it's we all have to understand that inherent in the risk analysis is accepting some degree of risk.
Right. I think that's exactly right. I think at some point your hope is to achieve a huge bias towards solutions that are more likely to be used or more likely than to meet everyone's expectations, but you'll never get 100%.
We have the issue of solutions that we haven't quite fully chewed out. Chris, you've addressed it and you've talked about the importance of not getting ahead of the commission and so on, but I'm wondering if other panelists care to take a stab at it. Are we at least talking about ruling out end-to-end encryption? Is that the very first brick in whatever a solution is?
I'm sorry, you mean by ruling out end-to-end encryption, you mean ruling out touching end-to-end encryption or banning end-to-end encryption?
Banning end-to-end encryption.
I don't know anybody who is advocating for banning end-to-end encryption. That would be a radical, and I would go on so far as to say very, very bad solution. I don't know that any advocates I don't know that there are any responsible advocates that are coming out and saying we should ban end-to-end encryption. I think they're saying how do we talk about access to devices? How do we talk about obligations of companies to provide technical assistance? How do we look at sort of reporting obligations, these sorts of things. So I think that it would be sort of the inverse of that. I think if anything, we've probably gotten pretty close to saying, okay, we need to leave end-to-end encryption. We need to leave end-to-end encryption alone when it comes to sort of the cryptographic standards, the integrity of that encryption alone.
But we can say some general ideas about what would shape the solution, right? I think all of us would probably. We want people to trust IT products, right? Particularly American IT products. We want people to use strong encryption. If OPM had used strong encryption, the Chinese would not be laughing over my SF-171 now, or SF-86, whatever it is, right? We want people to use strong encryption. We want to do this in a way that is as accommodating as possible to public safety, right? And somewhere in those principles, strong market, strong encryption, public safety, there is a solution set, right? And I think the commission can help by laying out some of these principles. There are ways to do it. Banning doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense. We used to chase companies around for software. They're very hard to catch. You can put on a thumb. You all know that. But there's also, you know, market incentives. When you take pictures of your Thanksgiving dinner and you lose the key, you probably want to recover them in some way. So we have not yet explored the terrain sufficiently. But we have some ideas about what other countries are doing, what we'd like to see for both American industry and for our own security. And I think we can move from there.
Arguably, though, key recovery encryption is not end-to-end because a third party has control over the decryption key.
Oh, I think Chris and I went through every single flavor of that at one point. Key recovery, key escrow, clipper chip. I don't even remember them all. And so I used to, at where I work, I used to have you had to pay $5 if you said public key infrastructure. Let's not try and cram it into the old boxes, right? Let's see what people can come up with if we can set these sort of guiding principles. I believe, and you heard this, I think, from the two congressmen, there's a desire to see people use strong encryption. Is there a way to do that that's as accommodating as possible to public safety? Don't worry about national security. I'm pretty sure they can take care of themselves.
And I think we have to play in the real world, too. We've banned heroin. We have millions of dollars that we invest in very draconian policies to prevent that, but I'm sure you can walk within two blocks of this building and find some.
Two blocks?
I don't know that means that we'll legalize it, though. So I agree with the framing that Jim put on the table. I thought that was an excellent framing, and I would add one thing to it with his permission, which is that if compromises are struck inside such a framing, and they will be, people need to understand what those compromises are. Mm-hmm. We need to be quite transparent about those, and the conditions under which that compromise has been struck will then cause people to say, I'll make use of that or I won't, right? In the reconciliation between ultimately security and convenience. So.
You'll be counting on mainstream technology companies to come up with some kind of solution that will become a de facto market standard in the way that for a while, everybody was carrying iPods. It wasn't a law, but everybody had them. That's the reasoning?
I think when it's all said and done, the marketplace continues to want these primary functions. If we can find a way to reconcile that with the attributes of individual security, collective security, economic vitality, I think that the normal forces in the private sector will take over from there.
I think one of the sort of the good examples of the ways we need to sort of balance things while still preserving some of the security integrity and security integrity as sort of even a Silicon Valley would endorse it. So Tor is a good example. No one's saying that it should be shut down, the dark web, right? There's a lot of sort of fear-mongering about that. The biggest problem on the dark web is child pornography. That's not fear-mongering. That is a fact. I have never spoken with him about it personally, but I would venture a guess that these are actually the kinds of things that keep Jim Comey up late at night, right? These are the kinds of you're charged with fixing a problem. The American people expect you to do a mission that includes really, really important work that's not just drug dealers or terrorists, as terrible as they might be, but things that sort of go really at the core of our collective values. And so we have to think about what do we expect when the FBI is facing these kinds of sort of adversaries and the tools, what do we expect law enforcement to use, right? What kinds of hacking do we expect them to do? What kinds of participation do we expect from American companies in helping to facilitate that? And how do we strike the calculation between allowing companies to develop products that are secure, just like Tor allows dissidents and all sorts of very important protective activity to occur, and at the same time, like stop really terrible things. So I think that that's sort of, it's helpful to understand that while there's not a 100% solution, walking away from this problem, saying we can just live with it, it's not something that's going to happen because there are federal agencies that are charged with a job to do, and the American people expect them to do it.
It sounds like the general contours of solution would be allowing end-to-end encryption, except in cases when there's third-party escrow of the private key. Certainly not banning end-to-end encryption, but hoping that something like a third-party escrow solution would become the de facto Silicon Valley offering. Is that essentially what we're talking about?
So I don't think so at all, and I think the Apple case is a great example of this, right? So the government has not said that they couldn't write the code at issue, right? Apple iPhones are created such that they will only run software that has been signed by Apple's key, right? So the government has two choices. They either get Apple's key, right? Key escrow, or they steal it, or I don't know, right? They get it somehow, and they make the software themselves. Or Apple makes the software. So the FBI is saying, okay, we believe you about the key escrow. Maybe not forever, and maybe this is a policy determination, but we believe you. You keep the key. You make sure that you maintain the security. But if you keep the key, you have to make the software for us, right? And there are reasonable questions about whether or not the law can compel that activity, whether it's a good idea, et cetera. But it's exactly the federal government's efforts to preserve these sort of red lines, right, of we will not engage in kiosk or et cetera, that's led to the situation we're currently in, and yet there still is not just non-cooperation, but outrage that they would even be asked.
I want to make sure, Chris.
I was just going to offer that, encryption is the dominant, but not the only piece of this, right? So I think what we're really after is end-to-end security. And that is achieved through a combination of mechanisms, not least which is encryption, but there are all sorts of things you do in software, hardware, procedures, doctrine, right, that essentially aid and abet that. And when we're all done, even the use of the word security perhaps is going to cause us to fall short of expectations. As Jim indicated earlier, nothing is secure, right, in the presence of a human being who either uses it or takes it to task. And so we need to be careful that, you know, we try to find a silver bullet because it will break our hearts.
So. And I think we also have to keep the flush toilet in mind, that yes. when we evaluate all the different things strong encryption and digital security give us, you know, the benefits we have from having indoor plumbing outweigh the fact that some evidence will be put beyond the reach of law enforcement.
If you had a biosensor in the toilet,
don't give them ideas.
But look, it's not the 1990s anymore. I know that's a news flash. This is why I work at a think tank, right? And so let's not try and resuscitate 1990s solutions like key escrow or third-party escrow. Didn't work then, not going to work now. But let's also not keep 1990s illusions that the world is a happy place where it will all be market democracies and war is over and the state can wither away. It's both gone. We need something new. You know, we need to say the old solutions didn't work, but the world we designed the encryption policies we have now for no longer exists. So we got to change.
The End of History was a lot of fun.
I love that. I love that book because it's such an easy exclamation point. History didn't end. They're back.
But then, unfortunately, what you've just said takes us back to square one again, and that is if we're not talking about key escrow, we're not talking about outlawing end-to-end encryption, then the question remains, what is a plausible solution? And I think a lot of people get upset at this point because they say, unless there's some kind of end game in mind, then what's the point of all the debate?
But the technologies that we're talking about and the implementation of those into various solutions is sufficiently complicated and dynamic. There isn't going to be one way, right? It's very likely going to be a requirement that for each broad application you have an understanding as to how, under the rule of law, you would achieve an exceptional access. And it might be that those instantiations differ broadly depending upon, you know, the choice made by the overall system architecture. So if you were to ask Google and Apple, how would you comply with the lawful order of the FBI under a court, they'd give you very different implementations because they've made different choices in terms of their architecture. There's nothing wrong with that. They both could satisfy exactly the same principle. It's not clear whether both of those would subscribe to that principle at this point in time, and that's in part what the Commission's trying to determine, whether the society writ large, represented in and through the government that convenes this commission, would come to some conclusions about what the value proposition is before we then talk about the technical implementation.
The fact that we can't identify a solution, it sounds to me like maybe we need a commission or something.
Yeah, possibly.
I don't know. But this is don't think of this as an encryption problem, and as a cybersecurity problem. This is coming up with rules for this new world that is shaped by the internet in ways we honestly didn't expect when it was commercialized. Right. I don't know if my colleagues would say that, but I know when I worked on this stuff in the mid-90s, I didn't expect it to be what it became.
No, right? Nor I. Yeah. And if I could speak for the government for a moment, just to say that the government doesn't have interests that are distinguished from the people that it serves. Now, we might conclude that from time to time based upon surface-level information. But when I hear Jim Comey speak, he's simply saying, this is what I've been charged to do by the Constitution I'm sworn to defend. And he doesn't use the word or. He doesn't say, I'm going to defend the part that is actually the significant part of my job jar to the exclusion, right, of something else. It's all of it. He is at once trying to figure out, how do I actually pursue domestic security and the defense of the privacies and expectations of individuals to be left alone when that's appropriate. And at once try to figure out how to support a private sector that has the right to pursue economic benefit. All of those things are great goods. I don't hear anyone in the government saying, we've got to rule one of those out in order to then achieve, you know, to some greater degree, someone that's left on the table. We're actually trying to figure out how to do all of these things.
Anybody else have final words?
Just sort of as a final thought, that, you know, if we're not happy with where... As Chris said, there is no difference between the government of the United States and the people of the United States, at least not in principle. So if the people of the United States determine that where the government is falling short of their expectations, or they have different risk assessments or different values, the beauty of our system is they are empowered to change it. But they are empowered to change it, not corporations, not even the director of the FBI, right? Really, the commission has to be the beginning of democratic participation, and you know, certainly by both parties.
And I love the sentiment, but unfortunately, and as a former FBI agent, I know the FBI does a lot of good work, but throughout history, they have often erred on deciding whose security means national security. And typically, when those decisions are made in a closed room where the public doesn't have a voice, it's no longer democratic principles that are being exercised. So again, I would just hope that this commission does as much in public as possible, and that it go beyond just what this commission is doing, but that the agencies themselves become much more transparent about how they're using the authorities that they're using.
And Jim, you can close it out.
The line I always remember from the Constitution is not that we're guaranteed happiness or perfection. We're guaranteed a system that lets us pursue it. So let's just get moving. You know, we every time we can do this a little bit better than the last time. It's the pursuit of happiness that we're going to engage in with this commission.
So we heard today there's no such thing as perfect security or perfect privacy, but I think we had a pretty perfect panel. So please join me in thanking the panel, as well as Chairman McCall and Senator Warner. And our moderator, David Pereira. I'll take the lack of questions to mean that everybody is fully on board with the commission that was proposed today by Chairman McCall and Senator Warner, and look forward to hosting all of you and for future events that BPC will be doing on this topic. Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Bipartisan Policy Center for permission to use this audio. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast on your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.